At the very last moment, she pivoted away from him and flung the water pitcher at the door instead, where it shattered as the soup bowl had the other day. She looked back at him and brushed her hair away from her face. Two hard little spots of red had now bloomed in the white, with the backs of her hands.
"Dirty bird," she panted. "Oh, you dirty birdie, how could you?"
He spoke rapidly, urgently, eyes flashing, riveted on her face. He was positive in that moment that his life might depend on what he was able to say in the next 20 seconds. "Annie, in 1871, women frequently died in childbirth. Misery gave her life for her husband and her best friend and her child. The spirit of misery will always..."
"I don't want her spirit!"
she screamed, hooking her fingers into claws and shaking them at him as if she would tear his eyes out.
"I want her! You killed her! You murdered her!"
Her hands snapped shut into fists again, and she drove them down like pistons, one on either side of his head. They punched deep into the pillow, and he bounced like a rag doll. His legs flared, and he cried out.
"I didn't kill her!"
he screamed. She froze, staring at him with that narrow black expression, that look of crevasse.
"Of course not,"
she said, bitterly sarcastic.
"And if you didn't, Paul Sheldon, who did it?"
"No one," he said more quietly. "She just died." Ultimately, he knew this to be the truth. If Misery Chastain had been a real person, he knew he might very well have been called upon to aid the police in their inquiries, as the euphemism went. After all, he had a motive. He had hated her. Ever since the third book, he had hated her. For April Fool's Day 4 years ago, he'd had a small booklet privately printed and had sent it to a dozen close acquaintances. It had been called Misery's Hobby. In it, Misery spent a cheerful country weekend boffing Growler, Ian's Irish setter. He might have murdered her, but he hadn't. In the end, in spite of his having grown to despise her, Misery's death had been something of a surprise to him. He had remained true enough to himself for art to imitate life, however feebly, to the very end of Misery's hackneyed adventures. She had died a most unexpected death. His cheerful capering had in no way changed the fact.
"You lie," Annie whispered. "I thought you were good, but you are not good. You are just a lying old dirty birdie."
"She slipped away, that's all. Sometimes that happens. It was like life when someone just..." She overturned the table by the bed. The one shallow drawer spilled out. His wristwatch and pocket change spilled out with it. He hadn't even known they were there. He cringed back from her.
"You must think I was born yesterday," she said.
Her lips drew back from her teeth.
"In my job, I saw dozens of people die. Hundreds, now that I think about it. Sometimes they go screaming, and sometimes they go in their sleep. They just slip away, the way you said, sure. But characters in stories do not just slip away. God takes us when he thinks it's time, and a writer is God to the people in a story. He made them up just like God made us up. And no one can get a hold of God to make him explain, all right, okay. But as far as Misery goes, I'll tell you one thing, you dirty bird. I'll tell you that God just happens to have a couple of broken legs. And God just happens to be in my house, eating my food and..."
She went blank then. She straightened up with her hands hanging limply by her sides, looking at the wall where an old photograph of the Arc de Triomphe was hung. She stood there, and Paul lay in his bed with round marks in the pillow beside his ears and looked at her. He could hear the water which had been in the pitcher dripping on the floor, and it came to him that he could commit murder. This was a question which had occurred to him from time to time, strictly academic, of course. Only now it wasn't, and he had the answer. If she hadn't thrown the pitcher, he would have shattered it on the floor himself and tried to shove one of the broken pieces of glass into her throat while she stood there, as inert as an umbrella stand. He looked down into the spillage from the drawer, but there was only the change, a pen, a comb, and his watch. No wallet. More important, no Swiss Army knife. She came back a little at a time, and the anger at least was gone. She looked down at him sadly. I think I better go now. I don't think I better be around you for a while. I don't think it's wise. Go? Where? It doesn't matter. A place I know. If I stay here, I'll do something unwise. I need to think. Goodbye, Paul. She strode across the room. Will you be back to give me my medication? He asked, alarmed. She grasped the doorknob and pulled the door shut without answering. For the first time, he heard the rattle of a key. He heard her footsteps going off down the hall. He winced as she cried out angrily, words he couldn't understand, and something else fell and shattered. A door slammed. An engine cranked over and then started up. The low, crunching squeal of tires turned on packed snow. Now the motor sound began to go away. It dwindled to a snore and then to a drone and was finally gone. He was alone. Alone in Annie Wilkes' house, locked in this room, locked in this bed. The distance between here and Denver was like, well, the distance between the Boston Zoo and Africa. He lay in bed looking at the ceiling, his throat dry and his heart beating fast. After a while, the parlor clock chimed noon and the tide began to go out. 51 hours. He knew just how long because of the pen, the flare fine liner he had been carrying in his pocket at the time of the crash. He had been able to reach down and snag it. Every time the clock chimed, he made a mark on his arm. 4 vertical marks and then a diagonal slash to seal the quintet. When she came back, there were 10 groups of 5 and 1 extra. The little groups, neat at first, grew increasingly jagged as his hands began to tremble. He didn't believe he had missed a single hour. He had dozed, but never really slept. The chiming of the clock woke him each time the hour came around. After a while, he began to feel hunger and thirst, even through the pain. It became something like a horse race. At first, King of Pain was far in the lead, and I got the hungries with some 12 furlongs back. Pretty Thirsty was nearly lost in the dust. Then around sunup on the day after she had left, I got the hungries actually gave King of Pain a brief run for his money. He had spent much of the night alternately dozing and waking in a cold sweat, sure that he was dying. After a while, he began to hope he was dying. Anything to be out of it. He'd never had any idea how bad the hurting could get. The pilings grew and grew. He could see the barnacles which encrusted them, could see pale, drowned things lying limply in the clefts of the wood. They were the lucky things. For them, the hurting was over. Around 3, he had lapsed into a bout of useless screaming. By noon of the second day, hour 24, he realized that as bad as the pain in his legs and pelvis was, something else was also making him hurt. It was withdrawal. Call this horse junkie's revenge if you wanted. He needed the capsules in more ways than one. He thought of trying to get out of the bed, but the thought of the thump and the drop and the accompanying escalation of pain constantly deterred him. He could imagine all too well, so vivid, how it would feel. He might have tried anyway, but she had locked the door. What could he do besides crawl across to it, snail-like, and lie there? In desperation, he pushed back the blankets with his hands for the first time, hoping against hope that it wasn't as bad as the shapes the blankets made seemed to suggest it was. It wasn't as bad. It was worse. He stared with horror at what he had become below the knees. In his mind, he heard the voice of Ronald Reagan in King's Row shrieking, "Where's the rest of me?" The rest of him was here, and he might get out of this. The prospects for doing so seemed ever more remote, but he supposed it was technically possible. But he might well never walk again, and surely not until each of his legs had been rebroken, perhaps in several places, and pinned with steel, and mercilessly overhauled, and subjected to 100 shriekingly painful indignities. She had splinted them. course he had known that, felt the rigid, ungiving shapes. But until now, he had not known what she had done it with. The lower parts of both legs were circled with slim steel rods that looked like the hacksawed remains of aluminum crutches. The rods had been strenuously taped so that from the knees down he looked a bit like Imhotep when he had been discovered in his tomb. The legs themselves meandered strangely up to his knees, turning outward here, jagging inward there. His left knee, a throbbing focus of pain, no longer seemed to exist at all. There was a calf and a thigh, and then a sickening bunch in the middle that looked like a salt dome. His upper legs were badly swollen and seemed to have bowed slightly outwards. His thighs, crotch, even his penis were all still mottled with fading bruises. He had thought his lower legs might be shattered. That was not so, as it turned out. They had been pulverized. Moaning, crying, he pulled the blankets back up. No rolling out of bed. Better to lie here, die here. Better to accept this level of pain, terrific as it was, until all pain was gone. Around 4 o'clock of the second day, Pretty Thirsty made its move. He had been aware of dryness in his mouth and throat for a long time, but now it began to seem more urgent. His tongue felt thick, too large. Swallowing hurt. He began to think of the pitcher of water she had dashed away. He dozed, woke, dozed. Day passed away. Night fell. He had to urinate. He laid the top sheet over his penis, hoping to create a crude filter, and urinated through it into his cupped and shaking hands. He tried to think of it as recycling, and drank what he had managed to hold, and then licked his wet palms. Here was something else he reckoned he would not tell people about, if he lived long enough to tell them anything. He began to believe she was dead. She was deeply unstable, and unstable people frequently took their own lives. He saw her, so vivid, pulling over to the side of the road in Old Bessie, taking a .44 from under the seat, putting it in her mouth, and shooting herself. "With misery dead, I don't want to live. Goodbye, cruel world," Annie cried through a rain of tears, and pulled the trigger. He cackled, then moaned, then screamed. The wind screamed with him, but took no other notice. Or an accident. Was that possible? Oh, yes, sir. He saw her driving grimly, going too fast, and then, "He doesn't get it from my side of the family," going blank and driving right off the side of the road, down and down and down, hitting once and bursting into a fireball, dying without even knowing it. If she was dead, he would die in here, a rat in a dry trap. He kept thinking unconsciousness would come and relieve him, but unconsciousness declined. Instead, hour 30 came, and hour 40. Now King of Pain and Pretty Thirsty merged into one single horse. I Got the Hungries had been left in the dust long since, and he began to feel like nothing more than a slice of living tissue on a microscope slide, or a worm on a hook. Something anyway, twisting endlessly, and waiting only to die. When she came in, he thought at first she must be a dream, but then reality, or mere brute survival, took over, and he began to moan and beg and plead, all of it broken, all of it coming from a deepening well of unreality. The one thing he saw clearly was that she was wearing a dark blue dress and a sprigged hat. It was exactly the sort of outfit he had imagined her wearing on the stand in Denver. Her color was high, and her eyes sparkled with life and vivacity. She was as close to pretty as Annie Wilkes ever could be. And when he tried to remember that scene later, the only clear images he could fix upon were her flushed cheeks and the sprigged hat. From some final stronghold of sanity and evaluative clarity, the rational Paul Sheldon had thought, "She looks like a widow who just got fucked after a 10-year dry spell." In her hand, she held a glass of water. A tall glass of water. "Take this," she said, and put a hand still cool from the out-of-doors on the back of his neck so he could sit up enough to drink without choking. He took 3 fast mouthfuls, the pores on the arid plain of his tongue widening and clamoring at the shock of the water, some of it spilling down his chin and onto the T-shirt he wore. And then she drew it away from him. He mewled for it, holding his shaking hands out.
"No," she said. "No, Pa. A little at a time or you'll vomit."
After a bit, she gave it back to him and allowed two more swallows.
"This stuff,"
he said, coughing. He sucked at his lips and ran his tongue over them and then sucked his tongue. He could vaguely remember drinking his own piss, how hot it had been, how salty.
"The capsules, pain. Please, Annie, please, for God's sake, help me. The pain is so bad."
"I know it is, but you must listen to me," she said, looking at him with that stern yet maternal expression. "I had to get away and think. I've thought deeply, and I hope I've thought well. I was not entirely sure. My thoughts are often muddy. I know that. I accept that. It's why I couldn't remember where I was all those times they kept asking me about. So I prayed. There is a God, you know, and he answers prayers. He always does. So I prayed. I said, 'Dear God, Paul Sheldon may be dead when I get back. But God said, he will not be. I have spared him, so you may shoo him the way he must go.'" She said show as shoo, but Paul was barely hearing her anyway. His eyes were fixed on the glass of water. She gave him another three swallows. He slurped like a horse, burped, then cried out as shudder cramps coursed through him. During all of this, she looked at him benignly.
"I will give you your medication and relieve your pain," she said. "But first, you have a job to do. I'll be right back."
She got up and headed for the door.
"No!"
he screamed. She took no notice at all. He lay in bed, cocooned in pain, trying not to moan, and moaning anyway. At first, he thought he had lapsed into delirium. What he was seeing was too bizarre to be sane. When Annie returned, she was pushing a charcoal grill in front of her.
"Annie, I'm in terrible pain."
Tears coursed down his cheeks. "I know, my dear." She kissed his cheek, the touch of her lips as gentle as the fall of a feather. "Soon." She left, and he looked stupidly at the charcoal grill, something meant for an outdoor summer patio which now stood in his room, calling up relentless images of idols and sacrifices. And sacrifice was what she had in mind, of course. When she came back, she was carrying the manuscript of Fast Cars, the only existing result of his 2 years' work, in one hand. In the other, she had a box of diamond blue-tip wooden matches.
"No,"
he said, crying and shaking. One thought worked at him, burned in him like acid. For less than $100, he could have had the manuscript photocopied in Boulder. People, Bryce, both of his ex-wives, hell, even his mother, had always told him he was crazy not to make at least one copy of his work and put it aside. After all, the Boulderado could catch on fire, or the New York townhouse. There might be a tornado or a flood or some other natural disaster. He had constantly refused, for no rational reason. It was just that making copies seemed a jinx thing to do. Well, here was the jinx and the natural disaster all rolled up in one. Here was Hurricane Annie. In her innocence, it had apparently never even crossed her mind that there might be another copy of Fast Cars someplace. And if he had just listened, if he had just invested the life, he replied to him. The manuscript, clean white hammer mill bond, with a title page topmost, lay on her lap. Her face was clear and calm.
"No,"
he said, turning his burning face away from her.
"Yes, it's filthy. That aside, it's also no good." "You wouldn't know good if it walked up and bit your nose off,"
he yelled, not caring. She laughed gently. Her temper had apparently gone on vacation. But Paul thought, knowing Annie Wilkes, it could arrive back unexpectedly at any moment, bags in hand. "Couldn't stand to stay away. How you doing?"
"First of all," she said, "good would not bite my nose off. Evil might, but not good. Second of all, I do know good when I see it. You are good, Paul. All you need is a little help. Now take the matches.
He shook his head stiffly back and forth.
No. Yes. No.
Yes.
No, God damn it! Use all the profanity you want. I've heard it all before. I won't do it.
He closed his eyes. When he opened them, she was holding out a cardboard square with the word Novru printed across the top in bright blue letters. Sample, the red letters just below the trade name read. Not to be dispensed without physician's prescription. Below the warning were four capsules in blister packs. He grabbed. She pulled the cardboard out of his reach.
When you burn it, she said. Then I'll give you the capsules. All four of these, I think. And the pain will go away. You'll begin to feel serene again. And when you've got a hold of yourself, I'll change your bedding. I see you've wet it. It must be uncomfortable. And I'll also change you. By then, I can give you some buttered toast. But until you burn it, Paul, I can do nothing. I'm sorry.
His tongue wanted to say, yes, yes, okay. And so he bit it. He rolled away from her again, away from the enticing, maddening cardboard square, the white capsules in her lozenge-shaped transparent blisters.
You're the devil, he said.
Again, he expected rage and got the indulgent laugh, with its undertones of knowing sadness.
Oh, yes. Yes! That's what a child thinks when Mummy comes into the kitchen and sees him playing with a cleaning fluid from under the sink. He doesn't say it that way, of course, because he doesn't have your education. He just says, Mommy, you're mean.
Her hand brushed his hair away from his hot brow. The fingers trailed down his cheek, across the side of his neck, and then squeezed his shoulder briefly, with compassion, before drawing away. The mother feels badly when her child says she's mean, or if he cries for what's been taken away as you are crying now. But she knows she's right, and so she does her duty, as I am doing mine. Three quick, dull thumps as Annie dropped her knuckles on the manuscript. 190,000 words and five lives that a well and pain-free Paul Sheldon had cared deeply about. 190,000 words and five lives that he was finding more dispensable as each moment passed. The pills. The pills. He had to have the goddamn pills. The lies were shadows. The pills were not. They were real. Paul.
No! He sobbed.
The faint rattle of the capsules in their blisters. Silence. Then the woody shuffle of the matches in their box. Paul.
No!
I'm waiting, Paul.
Why in Christ's name are you doing this asshole Horatio at the Bridge Act? And who in Christ's name are you trying to impress? You think this is a movie or a TV show and you're getting graded by some audience on your bravery? You can do what she wants or you can hold out. If you hold out, you'll die. And then she'll burn the manuscript anyway. So what are you going to do? Lie here and suffer for a book that would sell half as many copies as the least successful misery book you ever wrote? And which Peter Prescott would shit upon in his finest genteel disparaging manner when he reviewed it for that great literary oracle, Newsweek. Come on, come on. Wise up. Even Galileo recanted when he saw they really meant to go through. Paul, I'm waiting. Wait all day. Although I rather suspect that you may go into a coma before too long. I believe you are in a near comatose state now. And I have a lot of... Her voice droned away.
Yes. Give me this. Give me a blowtorch. Give me a baby Huey and a load of napalm. I'll drop a tactical nuke on it if that's what you want, you fucking beldame. So spoke the opportunist, the survivor. Yet another part, failing now, near comatose itself, went wailing off into the darkness. 190,000 words. Five lives, 2 years' work. And what was the real bottom line? The truth. What you knew about the fucking truth. There was the creak of bedsprings as she stood up.
Well, you are a very stubborn little boy, I must say. And I can't sit by your bed all night as much as I'd like to. After all, I've been driving for nearly an hour, hurrying to get back here. I'll drop in a bit and see if you've changed.
You burn it, then!
He yelled at her. She turned and looked at him. No, she said. I cannot do that. As much as I would like to, and spare you the agony you feel.
Why not?
Because, she said primly, you must do it of your own free will. He began to laugh then, and her face darkened for the first time since she had come back, and she left the room with a manuscript under her arm. When she came back an hour later, he took the matches. She laid the title page on the grill. He tried to light one of the blue tips and couldn't because it kept missing the rough strip or falling out of his hand. So Annie took the box and lit the match and put the lit match in his hand, and he touched it to the corner of the paper, and then let the match fall into the pot and watched, fascinated, as the flame tasted, then gulped. She had a barbecue fork with her this time, and when the page began to curl up, she poked it through the gaps in the grill.
This is going to take forever, he said. I can't...
No, we'll make quick work of it, she said. But you must burn a few of the single pages, Paul, as a symbol of your understanding. She now laid the first page of Fast Cars on the grill. Words he remembered writing some 24 months ago in the New York townhouse. I don't have no wheels, Tony Bonassaro said, walking up to the girl coming down the steps. And I am a slow learner, but I am a fast driver. Oh, it brought that day back like the right golden oldie on the radio. He remembered walking around the apartment from room to room, big with book, more than big, gravid, and here were the labor pains. He remembered finding one of Joan's bras under a sofa cushion earlier in the day, and she had been gone a full 3 months. Showed you what kind of a job the cleaning service did. He remembered hearing New York traffic and faintly the monotonous tolling of a church bell calling the faithful to Mass. He remembered sitting down. As always, the blessed relief of starting, a feeling that was like falling into a hole filled with bright light. As always, the glum knowledge that he would not write as well as he wanted to write. As always, the terror of not being able to finish, of accelerating into a blank wall. As always, the marvelous, joyful, nervy feeling of journey begun. He looked at Annie Wilkes and said, clearly but not loud, Annie, please don't make me do this. She held the matches immovably before him and said, you can do as you choose. So he burned his book. She made him burn the first page, the last page, and 9 pairs of pages from various points in the manuscript. Because 9, she said, was a number of power, and 9 doubled was lucky. He saw that she had used a magic marker to black out the profanities, at least as far as she had read. Now, she said when the 9th pair was burned, you've been a good boy and a real sport, and I know this hurts you almost as badly as your legs do, and I won't draw it out any longer. She removed the grill and set the rest of the manuscript into the pot, crunching down the crispy black curls of the pages he had already burned. The room stank of matches and burned paper. Smells like the devil's cloakroom, he thought deliriously. And if there had been anything in the wrinkled walnut shell that had once been his stomach, he supposed he would have vomited it up. She lit another match and put it in his hand. Somehow he was able to lean over and drop the match into the pot. It didn't matter anymore. It didn't matter. She was nudging him. Wearily he opened his eyes. It went out. Scratched another match and put it in his hand. So he somehow managed to lean over again, awakening rusty bandsaws in his legs as he did. Touched the match to the corner of the pile of manuscripts. This time the flame spread instead of shrinking and dying around the stick. He leaned back, eyes shut, listening to the crackling sound, feeling the full, baking heat.
Goodness! She cried, alarmed.
He opened his eyes and saw that charred bits of paper were wafting up from the barbecue on the heated air. Annie lumbered from the room.
He heard water from the tub taps thud into the floor pail. He idly watched a dark piece of manuscript float across the room and land on one of the gauzy curtains. There was a brief spark. He had time to wonder if perhaps the room was going to catch on fire. It winked once and then went out, leaving a tiny hole like a cigarette burn. Ash shifted down on the bed. Some landed on his arms. He didn't really care one way or the other. Annie came back, eyes trying to dart everywhere at once, trying to trace the course of each carbonized page as it rose and seesawed. Flames flipped and flickered over the edge of the pot.
"Goodness!"
she said again, holding the bucket of water and looking around, trying to decide where to throw it or if it needed to be thrown at all. Her lips were trembling and wet with spit. As Paul watched, her tongue darted out and slicked them afresh.
"Goodness! Goodness!"
It seemed to be all she could say. Even caught in the squeezing vice of his pain, Paul felt an instant of intense pleasure. This was what Annie Wilkes looked like when she was frightened. It was a look he would come to love. Another page wafted up, this one still running with little tendrils of low blue fire, and that decided her. With another goodness, she carefully poured the bucket of water into the barbecue pot. There was a monstrous hissing and a plume of steam. The smell was wet and awful, charred and yet somehow creamy. When she left, he managed to get up on his elbow one final time. He looked into the barbecue pot and saw something that looked like a charred lump of log floating in a brackish pond. After a while, Annie Wilkes came back. Incredibly, she was humming. She sat him up and pushed capsules into his mouth. He swallowed them and lay back, thinking, "I'm going to kill her." "Eat," she said from far away, and he felt stinging pain. He opened his eyes and saw her sitting beside him. For the first time, he was actually on a level with her, facing her. He realized with bleary, distant surprise that for the first time in untold eons, he was sitting too. Actually sitting up. "Who gives a shit?" he thought, and let his eyes slip shut again. The tide was in. The pilings were covered. The tide had finally come in, and the next time it went out, it might go out forever. So he was going to ride the waves while there were waves left to ride. He could think about sitting up later.
"Eat,"
she said again, and this was followed by a recurrence of pain. It buzzed against the left side of his head, making him whine and try to pull away.
"Eat, Paul! You've got to come out of it enough to eat her!"
Zing! His earlobe. She was pinching it.
"Kay," he muttered. "Kay, don't yank it off, for God's sake!"
He forced his eyes open. Each lid felt as if it had a cement block dangling from it. Immediately the spoon was in his mouth, dumping hot soup down his throat. He swallowed to keep from drowning. Suddenly, out of nowhere, "The most amazing comeback this announcer has ever seen, ladies and gentlemen," "I Got the Hungries" came bursting into view. It was as if that first spoonful of soup had awakened his gut from a hypnotic trance. He took the rest as fast as she could spoon it into his mouth, seeming to grow more rather than less hungry as he slurped and swallowed. He had a vague memory of her wheeling out the sinister smoking barbecue and then wheeling in something which, in his drugged and fading state, he had thought might be a shopping cart. The idea had caused him to feel neither surprise nor wonder. He was visiting with Annie Wilkes, after all. Barbecues. Shopping carts. Maybe tomorrow a parking meter or a nuclear warhead. When you lived in the fun house, the laugh riot just never stopped. He had drifted off, but now he realized that the shopping cart had been a folded-up wheelchair. He was sitting in it, his splinted legs stuck stiffly out in front of him, his pelvic area feeling uncomfortably swollen and not very happy with the condition. "She put me in it while I was conked out," he thought. "Lifted me. Dead weight. Christ, she must be strong."
"Finished," she said. "I'm pleased to see how well you took that soup, Paul. I believe you're going to mend. We will not say good is new, alas, no. But if we don't have any more of these contretemps, I believe you'll mend just fine.
Now I'm going to change your nasty old bed, and when that's done, I'm going to change the nasty old you. And then if you're not having too much pain and still feel hungry, I'm going to let you have some toast.
Thank you, Annie, he said humbly, and thought, your throat. If I can, I'll give you a chance to lick your lips and say, goodness, but only once, Annie. Only once.
4 hours later, he was back in bed, and he would have burned all his books for even a single novel. Sitting hadn't bothered him a bit while he was doing it. Not with enough shit in his bloodstream to have put half the Prussian army to sleep. But now it felt as if a swarm of bees had been loosed in the lower half of his body. He screamed very loudly. The food must have done something for him, because he could not remember being able to scream so loudly since he had emerged from the dark cloud. He sensed her standing just outside the bedroom door in the hallway for a long time before she actually came in. Immobile, turned off, unplugged, gazing blankly at no more than the doorknob, or perhaps the pattern of lines in her own hands. Here, she gave him his medication. 2 capsules this time. He swallowed them, holding her wrist to steady the glass. I bought you 2 presents in town, she said, getting up.
Did you? He croaked.
She pointed at the wheelchair, which brooded in the corner with its steel leg rest stuck stiffly out.
I'll show you the other one tomorrow. Now get some sleep, Paul.
But for a long time, no sleep came. He floated on the dope and thought about the situation he was in. It seemed a little easier now. It was easier to think about than the book which he had created and then uncreated. Things. Isolated things like pieces of cloth which may be pieced together to make a quilt. They were miles from the neighbors who Annie said didn't like her. What was the name? Boynton. No, Roydman. That was it, Roydman. And how far from the town? Not too far, surely. He was in a circle whose diameter might be as small as 50 or as large as 45. Annie Wilkes' house was in that circle, and the Roydmans and downtown Sidewinder, however pitifully small that might be. And my car, my Camaro, somewhere in that circle, too. Did the police find it? He thought not. He was a well-known person. If a car had been found with tags registered in his name, a little elementary checking would have shown he had been in Boulder and then dropped out of sight. The discovery of his wrecked and empty car would have prompted a search, stories on the news. She never watches the news on TV, never listens to the radio at all, unless she's got one with an earplug or phones. It was all a little like a dog in a Sherlock Holmes story, the one that didn't bark. His car hadn't been found because the cops hadn't come. If it had been found, they would have checked everyone in his hypothetical circle, wouldn't they? And just how many people could there be in such a circle, here close to the top of the western slope? Roydman's, Annie Wilkes, maybe 10 or 12 others. And just because it hadn't been found so far didn't mean it wouldn't be found. His vivid imagination, which he had from anyone on his mother's side, now took over. The cop was in which his voice, a famous writer named Paul Sheldon. Seats on the dashboard, but no sign of him. Must have crawled out, maybe even have wandered away in a daze. That was a laugh, considering the state of his legs. But of course they would not know what injuries he might have sustained. They would only assume that if he was not here, he must have been strong enough to get at least a little way. The course of their deductions was not apt to lead to such an unlikely possibility as kidnapping, at least not at first. Probably never. Do you remember seeing anyone on the road the day of the storm? Tall man, 42 years old, sandy hair. Probably wearing blue jeans and a check flannel shirt and a parka. Might have looked sort of bunged up. Hell, might not even have known who he was. Annie would give the cop coffee in the kitchen. Annie would be mindful that all the doors between there and the spare bedroom should be closed, in case he should groan.
Why, no, officer, I didn't see a soul. In fact, I came back from town just as quick as I could when Tony Roberts told me that bad old storm wasn't turning south after all.
The cop setting down the coffee cup and getting up.
Well, if you should see anyone fit in the description, ma'am, I hope you'll get in touch with us just as fast as you can. He's quite a famous person, been in People magazine,
some other ones, too. I certainly will, officer.
And away he would go. Maybe something like that had already happened, and he just didn't know about it. Maybe his imaginary cop's actual counterpart or counterparts had visited Annie while he was doped out. God knew he spent enough time doped out. More thought convinced him it was unlikely. He wasn't Joe Blow from Kokomo, just some transient blowing through. He had been in People, First Bestseller, and Us, First Divorce. There had been a question about him one Sunday in Walter Scott's personality parade. There would have been rechecks, maybe by phone, maybe by the cops themselves. When a celebrity, even a quasi-celebrity like a writer, disappeared, the heat came on. You're only guessing, man. Maybe guessing, maybe deducing. Either way, it was better than just lying here and doing nothing. What about guardrails? He tried to remember and couldn't. He could only remember reaching for his cigarettes and the amazing way the ground and sky had switched places, then darkness. But again, deduction or educated guesswork, if you wanted to be snotty, made it easier to believe there had been none. Smashed guardrails and snapped guy wires would have alerted road crews. So what exactly had happened? He had lost control at a place where there wasn't much of a drop, that was what. Just enough grade to allow the car to flip over in space. If the drop had been steeper, there would have been guardrails. If the drop had been steeper, Annie Wilkes would have found it difficult or impossible to get him, let alone drag him back to the road by herself. So where was his car? Buried in the snow, of course. Paul put his arm over his eyes and saw a town plow coming up the road where he had crashed only 2 hours earlier. The plow was a dim orange blob in the driving snow near the end of this day. The man driving is bundled to the eyes. On his head, he wears an old-fashioned trainman's cap of blue and white pillow tick. To his right, at the bottom of a shallow slope, which will not far from here deepen into a more typical upcountry gorge, lies Paul Sheldon's Camaro, with a faded blue Heart for President sticker on the rear bumper, just about the brightest thing down there. The guy driving the plow doesn't see the car. Bumper sticker is too faded to catch his eye. The wing plows block most of his side vision, and besides, it's almost dark and he's beat. He just wants to finish this last run so he can turn the plow over to his relief and get a hot cup of Joe. He sweeps past. The plow spuming cloudy snow into the gully. The Camaro, already drifted to the windows, is now buried to the roofline. Later, in the deepest part of a stormy twilight, when even the things directly in front of you look unreal, the second shift man drives by, headed in the opposite direction, and entombs it. Paul opened his eyes and looked at the plaster ceiling. There was a fine series of hairline cracks up there that seemed to make a trio of interlocked W's. He had become very familiar with them over the endless run of days he had lain here since coming out of the cloud, and now he traced them again, idly thinking of W words, such as wicked and wretched and witch-like and wriggling. Yes. Could have been that way. Could have been. Had she thought of what might happen when his car was found? She might have. She was nuts, but being nuts didn't make her stupid. Yet it had never crossed her mind that he might have a duplicate of fast cars. Yeah, she was right. That bitch was right. I didn't. Images of the blackened pages floated up. The flames, the sounds, the smell of the uncreation. He gritted his teeth against the images and tried to shut his mind away from them. Vivid was not always good. No, you didn't. But 9 out of 10 writers would have. At least they would if they were getting paid as much as you have been for even the non-misery books. She never even thought of it. She's not a writer. Neither is she stupid, as I think we've both agreed. I think that she is filled with herself. She does not just have a large ego, but one which is positively grandiose. Burning it seemed to her the proper thing to do, and the idea that her concept of the proper thing to do might be short-circuited by something so piddling as a bank Xerox machine and a couple of rolls of quarters. That blip just never crossed her screen, my friend. His other deductions might be like houses built on quicksand. But this view of Annie Wilkes seemed to him as solid as the Rock of Gibraltar. Because of his researches for Misery, he had rather more than a layman's understanding of neurosis and psychosis. And he knew that although a borderline psychotic might have alternating periods of deep depression and almost aggressive cheerfulness and hilarity, the puffed and infected ego underlay all, positive that all eyes were upon him or her, positive that he or she was starring in a great drama. The outcome was a thing for which untold millions waited with held breath. Such an ego simply forbade certain lines of thought. These lines were predictable because they all stretched in the same direction, from the unstable person to objects, situations, or other persons outside of the subject's field of control, or fantasy. To the neurotic, there might be some difference, but to the psychotic, they were one and the same. Annie Wilkes had wanted fast cars destroyed, and so to her, there had been only one copy. Maybe I could have saved the damn thing by telling her there were more. She would have seen destroying the manuscript was futile. His breathing, which had been slowing toward sleep, suddenly caught in his throat and his eyes widened. Yes, she would have seen it was futile. She would have been forced to acknowledge one of those lines leading to a place beyond her control. The ego would be hurt, squealing.
I have such a temper!
If she had been clearly faced with the fact that she couldn't destroy his dirty book, might she not have decided to destroy the creator of the dirty book instead? After all, there was no copy of Paul Sheldon. His heart was beating fast. In the other room, the clock began to bong, and overhead he heard her thumping footfalls across the ceiling. The faint sound of her urinating, the toilet flushing, the heavy pad of her feet as she went back to bed, the creak of the spring.
You won't make me mad again, will you?
His mind suddenly tried to break into a gallop, an overbred trotter trying to break stride. What, if anything, did all this dime store psychoanalysis mean in terms of his car? About when it was found? What did it mean to him?
Wait a minute, he whispered in the dark. Wait a minute, wait a minute. Just hold the phone. Slow down.
He put his arm across his eyes again and again conjured up the state trooper with the dark sunglasses and the overlong sideburns. We found an overturned car halfway down Humbuggy Mountain, the state trooper was saying, and blah-de-blah-de-blah. Only this time, Annie doesn't invite him to stay for coffee. This time, she isn't going to feel safe until he's out of her house and far down the road. Even in the kitchen, even with two closed doors between them and the guest room, even with a guest doped to his ears, the trooper might hear a groan. If his car was found, Annie Wilkes would know she was in trouble, wouldn't she?
Yes, Paul whispered.
His legs were beginning to hurt again, but in the dawning horror of this recognition, he barely noticed. She would be in trouble not because she had taken him to her house, especially if it was closer than Sidewinder, and so Paul believed it to be. For that, they would probably give her a medal and a lifetime membership in the Misery Chastain fan club. To Paul's endless chagrin, there actually was such a thing. The problem was she had taken him to her house and installed him in the guest room and told no one. No phone call to the local ambulance service. This is Annie up on the Humbuggy Mountain Road, and I've got a fellow here who looks a bit like King Kong used him for a trampoline. The problem was she had filled him full of dope to which she was certainly not supposed to have access. Not if he was even half as hooked as he thought he was. The problem was, she had followed the dope with a weird sort of treatment, sticking IV needles in his arms, splinting his legs with sawed-off pieces of aluminum crutches. The problem was, Annie Wilkes had been on the stand up there in Denver. And not as a supporting witness, either, Paul thought. I'd bet the house and a lot on that. So she watches the cop go down the road in his spandy-clean cruiser, spandy clean except for the caked chunks of snow and salt nestled in the wheel wells and under the bumpers, that is. And she feels safe again. But not too safe, because now she is like an animal with its wind up. Way, way up. The cops will look and look and look, because he is not just good old Joe Blow from Kokomo. He is Paul Sheldon, the literary Zeus from whose brow sprang Misery Chastain, darling of the dump bins and sweetheart of the supermarkets. Maybe when they don't find him, they'll stop looking, or at least look someplace else. But maybe one of the Roydmans saw her going by that night and saw something funny in the back of old Bessie. Something wrapped in a quilt. Something vaguely manlike. Even if they hadn't seen such a thing, she wouldn't put it past the Roydmans to make up a story to get her in trouble. They didn't like her. The cops might come back, and next time her house guest might not be so quiet. He remembered her eyes darting around aimlessly when the fire in the barbecue pot was on the verge of getting out of control. He could see her tongue slicking her lips. He could see her walking back and forth, hands clenching and unclenching, peeking every now and then into the guest room where he lay lost in his cloud. Every now and then she would utter, "Goodness!" to the empty rooms. She had stolen a rare bird with beautiful feathers, a rare bird which came from Africa. And what would they do if they found out? Why, put her up on the stand again, of course. Put her up on the stand again in Denver. And this time she might not walk free. He took his arm away from his eyes. He looked at the interlocking W's swaying drunkenly across the ceiling. He didn't need his elbow over his eyes to see the rest. She might hang on to him for a day or a week. It might take a follow-up phone call or visit to make her decide to get rid of her rara avis. But in the end, she would do it, just as wild dogs begin to bury their illicit kills after they've been hunted a while. She would give him 5 pills instead of 2, or perhaps smother him with a pillow. Perhaps she would simply shoot him. Surely there was a rifle around somewhere. Almost everyone living in the high country had one, and that would take care of the problem. No, not the gun. Too messy. Might leave evidence. None of that had happened yet because no one had found the car. They might be looking for him in New York or L.A., but no one was looking for him in Sidewinder, Colorado. But in the spring, the W's straggled across the ceiling, washed, wiped, wasted. The throbbing in his legs was more insistent. The next time the clock bonged, she would come, but he was almost afraid she would read his thoughts on his face, like the bare premise of a story too gruesome to write. His eyes drifted left. There was a calendar on the wall. It showed a boy riding a sled down a hill. It was February, according to the calendar. But if his calculations were right, it was already early March. Annie Wilkes had just forgotten to turn the page. How long before the melting snows revealed his Camaro with its New York plates and its registration in the glove compartment, proclaiming the owner to be Paul Sheldon? How long before that trooper called on her, or until she read it in the paper? How long until the spring melt? 6 weeks? 5? That could be the length of my life, Paul thought, and began shuddering. By then his legs were fully awake, and it was not until she had come in and given him another dose of medicine that he was able to fall asleep. The next evening she brought him the Royal. It was an office model from an era when such things as electric typewriters, color TVs, and touch-tone telephones were only science fiction. It was as black and as proper as a pair of high-buttoned shoes. Glass panels were set into the sides, revealing the machine's levers, springs, ratchets, and rods. A steel return lever, dull with disuse, jutted to one side like a hitchhiker's thumb. The roller was dusty, its hard rubber scarred and pitted. The letters Royal ran across the front of the machine in a semicircle. Grunting, she set it down on the foot of the bed between his legs, after holding it up for his inspection for a moment. He stared at it. Was it grinning? Christ, it looked like it was. Anyway, it already looked like trouble. The ribbon was a faded two-tone red over black. He had forgotten there were such ribbons. The sight of this one called up no pleasant nostalgia. Well, she was smiling eagerly. What do you think? It's nice, he said at once. A real antique. Her smile clouded. I didn't buy it for an antique. I bought it for second hand. Good second hand. He responded with immediate glibness. Hey, there ain't no such thing as an antique typewriter. Not when you come right down to it. A good typewriter lasts damn near forever. These old office babies are tanks. He If he could have reached it, he would have patted it. If he could have reached it, he would have kissed it. Her smile returned. His heartbeat slowed a little.
I got it at Used News. Isn't that a silly name for a store? But Nancy Dartmunger, the lady who runs it, is a silly woman.
Annie darkened a little, but he saw at once that she was not darkening at him. The survival instinct he was discovering might be only instinct itself, but it created some really amazing shortcuts to empathy. He found himself becoming more attuned to her moods, her cycles. He listened to her tick as if she were a wounded clock.
As well as silly, she's bad, Dartmunger. Her name ought to be Whoremonger. Divorced twice, and now she's living with a bartender. That's why, when you said it was an antique...
It looks fine, he said. She paused a long moment, and then said, as if confessing,
It has a missing N.
Does it?
Yes. See?
She tilted the typewriter up so he could peer at the banked semicircle of keys and see the missing striker like a missing molar in a mouthful of teeth, worn but otherwise complete.
I see.
She set it back down. The bed rocked a little. Paul guessed the typewriter must weigh as much as 50 pounds. It had come from a time when there were no alloys, no plastics. Also, no six-figure book advances. No movie tie-in editions. No USA Today. No Entertainment Tonight. No celebrities doing ads for credit cards or vodka. The Royal grinned at him, promising trouble.
She wanted $45, but gave me 5 off because of the missing N.
She offered him a crafty smile. No fool she, it said. He smiled back. The tide was in. That made both smiling and lying easy.
Gave it to you?
You mean you didn't dick her? Annie preened a little.
I told her N was an important letter, she allowed.
Well, good for you.
Damn!
Here was a new discovery. Sycophancy was easy once you got the hang of it. Her smile grew sly, inviting him to share a delicious secret.
I told her N was one of the letters in my favorite writer's name.
It's 2 of the letters in my favorite nurse's name. Her smile became a glow. Incredibly, a blush rose in her solid cheeks. That's what it would look like, he thought, if you built a furnace inside the mouth of one of those idols in the H.R. Rider Haggard stories. That is what it would look like at night.
You fooler, she simpered.
I'm not, he said, not at all.
Well...
She looked off for a moment. Not blank, but just pleased. A little flustered, taking a moment to gather her thoughts. Paul could have taken some pleasure in the way this was going, if not for the weight of the typewriter, as solid as the woman and also damaged. It sat there, grinning with its missing tooth, promising trouble.
The wheelchair was much more expensive, she said. Ostomy supplies have gone right out of sight since I...
She broke off, frowned. Cleared her throat. Then she looked back at him, smiling.
But it's time you began sitting up, and I don't begrudge the cost one tiny bit. And of course you can't type lying down, can you?
No.
I've got a board. I cut it to size. And paper. Wait.
She dashed from the room like a girl, leaving Paul and the typewriter to regard each other. His grin disappeared the moment her back was turned. The Royals never varied. He supposed later that he had pretty well known what all this was about, just as he supposed he had known what the typewriter would sound like, how it would clack through its grin like that old comic strip character, Ducky Daddles. She came back with a package of caressable bond and shrink wrap and a board about 3 feet wide by 4 feet long.
Look!
She put the board on the arms of the wheelchair that stood by his bed like some solemn skeletal visitor. Already he could see the ghost of himself behind that board, pent in like a prisoner. She put the typewriter on the board facing the ghost, and put the package of caressable bond, the paper he hated most in all the world because of the way the type blurred when the pages were shuffled together, beside it. She had now created a kind of cripple's study.
What do you think?
It looks good, he said, uttering the biggest lie of his life with perfect ease, and then asked the question to which he already knew the answer. "What will I write there, do you think?"
"Oh, but Paul,"
she said, turning to him, her eyes dancing animatedly in her flushed face.
"I don't think. I know. You're going to use this typewriter to write a new novel. Your best novel. Misery's Return."
Misery's Return. He felt nothing at all. He supposed a man who had just cut his hand off in a power saw might feel the same species of nothing as he stood regarding his spouting wrist with dull surprise.
"Yes!"
Her face shone like a searchlight. Her powerful hands were clasped between her breasts.
"It'll be a book just for me, Paul. My payment for nursing you back to health. The one and only copy of the newest Misery book. I'll have something no one else in the world has, no matter how much they might want it. Think of it."
Annie, Misery is dead. But already, incredibly, he was thinking, "I could bring her back." The thought filled him with tired revulsion, but no real surprise. After all, a man who could drink from a floor bucket should be capable of a little directed writing.
"No, she's not," Annie replied dreamily. "Even when I was so mad at you, I knew she wasn't really dead. I knew you couldn't really kill her. Because you're good."
"Am I?" he said, and looked at the typewriter. It grinned at him. "We're going to find out just how good you are, old buddy," it whispered.
"Yes."
"Annie, I don't know if I can sit in that wheelchair. Last time
it hurt, you bet it did. And it will hurt the next time, too. Maybe even a little more. But there will come a day, and it won't be long either, although it may seem longer to you than it really is, when it hurts a little less, and a little less, and a little less."
"Annie, will you tell me one thing?"
"Of course, dear."
"If I write this story for you..."
"Novel, a nice big one like all the others, maybe even bigger."
He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them. "Okay. If I write this novel for you, will you let me go when it's done?" For a moment, unease slipped cloudily across her face. And then she was looking at him carefully, studiously.
"You speak as though I were keeping you prisoner, Paul."
He said nothing, only looked at her.
"I think that by the time you finish, you should be up to the strain of meeting people again,"
she said.
"Is that what you want to hear?"
"That's what I wanted to hear, yes."
"Well, honestly, I knew writers were supposed to have big egos, but I guess I didn't understand that meant ingratitude, too."
He went on looking at her, and after a moment she looked away, impatient and a little flustered. At last he said, "I'll need all the Misery books if you've got them, because I don't have my concordance."
"Of course I have them,"
she said.
"Then, what's a concordance?"
"It's a loose-leaf binder where I have all my Misery stuff," he said. "Characters and places mostly, but cross-indexed 3 or 4 different ways. Timelines, historical stuff." He saw she was barely listening. This was the second time she'd shown not the slightest interest in a trick of the trade that would have held a class of would-be writers spellbound. The reason, he thought, was simplicity itself. Annie Wilkes was the perfect audience, a woman who loves stories without having the slightest interest in the mechanics of making them. She was the embodiment of that Victorian archetype, constant reader. She did not want to hear about his concordance and indices, because to her, Misery and the characters surrounding her were perfectly real. Indices meant nothing to her. If he had spoken of a village census in Little Dunthorpe, she might have showed some interest.
"I'll make sure you get the books. They're a little dog-eared, but that's a sign a book has been well-read and well-loved, isn't it?"
"Yes," he said. "No need to lie this time." "Yes, it is."
"I'm going to study up on bookbinding," she said dreamily. "I'm going to bind Misery's Return myself. Except for my mother's Bible, it'll be the only real book I own."
That's good, he said, just to say something. He was feeling a little sick to his stomach.
I'll go out now so you can put on your thinking cap, she said. This is exciting, don't you think so?
Yes, Annie, I sure do.
I'll be in with some breast of chicken and mashed potatoes and peas for you in half an hour. Even a little jello, because you've been such a good boy. And I'll make sure you get your pain medication right on time. You can even have an extra pill in the night if you need it. I want to make sure you get your sleep, because you have to go back to work tomorrow. You'll mend faster when you're working, I bet.
She went to the door, paused there for a moment, and then grotesquely blew him a kiss. The door closed behind her. He did not want to look at the typewriter and for a while resisted, but at last his eyes rolled helplessly toward it. It sat on the bureau, grinning. Looking at it was a little like looking at an instrument of torture, boot, rack, strappado, which is standing inactive, but only for the moment.
I think that by the time you finish, you should be up to the strain of meeting people again.
Oh, Annie, you were lying to both of us. I knew it, and you did, too. I saw it in your eyes. The limited vista now opening before him was extremely unpleasant. 6 weeks of life, which he would spend suffering with his broken bones and renewing his acquaintance with Misery Chastain, nay, Carmichael, followed by a hasty internment in the backyard. Or perhaps she would feed his remains to Misery the pig. That would have a certain justice, black and gruesome though it might be. Then don't do it. Make her mad. She's like a walking bottle of nitroglycerin as it is. Bounce her around a little. Make her explode. Better than lying here suffering. He tried looking up at the interlocked W's, but all too soon he was looking at the typewriter again. It stood atop the bureau, mute and thick and full of words he did not want to write, grinning with its one missing tooth.
I don't think you believe that, old buddy. I think you want to stay alive, even if it does hurt. If it means bringing Misery back for an encore, you'll do it. You try, anyway. But first you're going to have to deal with me. And I don't think I like your face.
Makes us even, Paul croaked. This time he tried looking out the window, where fresh snow was falling. Soon enough, however, he was looking at the typewriter again, with avid, repulsed fascination, not even aware of just when his gaze had shifted. Getting into the chair didn't hurt as much as he had feared, and that was good, because previous experience had shown him that he could hurt plenty afterwards. She set the tray of food down on the bureau and rolled the wheelchair over to the bed. She helped him to sit up. There was a dull, thudding flare of pain in his pelvic area, but it subsided. And then she leaned over, the side of her neck pressing against his shoulder like the neck of a horse. For an instant he could feel the thump of her pulse, and his face twisted in revulsion. Then her right arm was firmly around his back, her left under his buttocks. "Try not to move from the knees while I do this," she said, and then simply slid him into the chair. She did it with the ease of a woman sliding a book into an empty slot in her bookcase. Yes, she was strong. Even in good shape, the outcome of a fight between him and Annie would have been in doubt. And as he was now, it would be like Wally Cox taking on Boom Boom Mancini. She put the board in front of him. "See how well it fits?" she said, and went to the bureau to get the food. "Annie."
"Yes?"
"I wonder if you could turn that typewriter around so it faces the wall." She frowned.
"Why in the world do you want me to do that?"
"Because I don't want it grinning at me all night." "Old superstition of mine," he said. "I always turn my typewriter to the wall before I start writing." He paused and added, "Every night while I am writing, as a matter of fact."
"It's like step on a crack, break your mother's back," she said. "I never step on a crack if I can help it."
She turned it around so it grinned at nothing but blank wall.
"Better?"
"Much."
"You are such a silly,"
she said, and came over and began to feed him. He dreamed of Annie Wilkes in the court of some fabulous Arabian caliph, conjuring imps and genies from bottles, and then flying around the court on a magic carpet. When the carpet banked past him, her hair streamed out behind her. Her eyes were as bright and flinty as the eyes of a sea captain navigating among icebergs. He saw it was woven all in green and white. It made a Colorado license plate. "Once upon a time," Annie was calling. "Once upon a time it came to pass. This happened in the days when my grandfather's grandfather was a boy. This is the story of how a poor boy... I heard this from a man who... Once upon a time. Once upon a time." When he woke up, Annie was shaking him, and bright morning sun was slanting in the window. The snow had ended. "Wake up, sleepyhead!" Annie was almost trilling. "I've got yogurt and a nice boiled egg for you, and then it will be time for you to begin." He looked at her eager face and felt a strange new emotion. Hope. He had dreamed that Annie Wilkes was Scheherazade, her solid body clad in diaphanous robes, her big feet stuffed into pink sequined slippers with curly toes, as she rode on her magic carpet and chanted the incantatory phrases which open the doors of the best stories. But of course it wasn't Annie that was Scheherazade. He was. And if what he wrote was good enough, if she could not bear to kill him until she discovered how it all came out, no matter how much or how loudly her animal instincts yelled for her to do it, that she must do it, might he not have a chance? He looked past her and saw she had turned the typewriter around before waking him. It grinned resplendently at him with its missing tooth, telling him it was all right to hope and noble to strive, but in the end it was doom alone which would count. She rolled him over to the window, so the sun fell on him for the first time in weeks, and it seemed to him he could feel his pasty white skin, dotted here and there with minor bedsores, murmur its pleasure and thanks.